Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, Thursday morning. Thursday morning.
I wish
it was Friday too, but it's the 26th of June. It is a Thursday, and we thank you very, very much for being with us. I've just taken the mood of the room here, and I would say this group is ready to go.
Fired up.
Yeah, fired up and ready to go. So we are very excited about that. We're even more excited that you're with us along for the ride. We always welcome you to be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I just want to do a quick shout out, but we had an on-the-road event last night at the Saratoga City Center, where with Northshire Bookstore and the Saratoga Book Festival, we welcomed best-selling author and Oprah pick, Wally Lamb, and about his new book, The River is Waiting. And it was absolutely an amazing sort of emotional kind of life-changing event, which was really, for anyone there, it was just incredible. It'll be on the book show, I think, in 2 weeks. But I just wanted to thank all the folks who came out. We had a full room at the City Center, and they were knocking down the doors and sold a lot of books and a lot of support for independent bookstores and independent media, as well as just great writing by Wally Lamb. So my thanks to Rachel Person at the Northshire Bookstore, as well as to Ellen Beale of the Saratoga Book Festival, and of course to the amazing Wally Lamb, who was with us last night. So that is coming up on our program, and we look forward to sharing that with you in the days to come. We have a lot to talk about this morning, so we will get to it and get just right on the docket here. Let me introduce this fantastic group. We welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois to the program. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here on the anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter. Now, for reasons that still confuse me, the president's been disparaging the United Nations in the last couple of days. But, you know, I think they do good work. Have the capacity to do good work.
I think they do good work. yes. So we take a moment to think of that this morning. We welcome Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMond. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. Glad to be back.
It's really good to have you back. We've missed you, and it's wonderful to have you in the studio. Dr. Karen Riedel is here, Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College. Since 2023, she has been President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm very glad to be here. And adding on to what Teresa said, it's very easy to criticize the United Nations for everything they have not achieved, but we don't know what they have managed to avoid. Right?
That's right. So, yeah, that's a great point. We'll talk a little bit about that this morning. Mayor Kathy Sheehan is with us, the mayor of the city of Albany, and it's a delight to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Is it weird to just be sitting on the sidelines as people are fighting for your job?
Well, I'm glad that the bulk of the fight is over in the Democratic primary, and it's no surprise that I'm pleased with the outcome. I had endorsed Dorsia Pleers, and I think she'll make a great mayor. And it's an opportunity, you know, with the primary so early, you know, back in the day when I ran for mayor, the primary was in September and then the general, you know, just a couple months later. So this is a bit of a longer path, but look forward to continuing to work with Dorsey and have an opportunity to make sure that we have a good handoff, as they say, because there's, as you know, a lot going on.
A lot going on. Dorsey was a panelist on the show for a long time and had to step off when she started to run for mayor. So we're very excited and hope if it goes her way that she'll come back as a panelist. And then when you're done, we'll sign you up for a longer term. If that is okay with you. Let me ask you real quickly before we get to all of the news of the day. I know you were at the National Conference of Mayors over the past week, and what was, I assume, many of the things that were going to be discussed today were first and foremost on the minds of the mayors across the country.
Well, certainly the cuts being proposed in Washington are of great concern. We strongly believe that the housing initiatives, HUD, the community block, the block grant program that exists, you know, all of those have been successful. We can point to those successes, and the cuts would be devastating. We're looking at potentially just in this region alone, thousands of people becoming homeless within 90 days of some of these cuts. We're also very concerned that as we ramp up what people have been asking us for, which is more mental health case managers and workers on the streets, ensuring that we're addressing the substance use and mental health issues that still cause a lot of quality of life issues in communities across the country, that with the Medicaid cuts that are being proposed, that that could really have a huge impact on our ability to continue the progress that we've been able to make. So that was a concern that was a bipartisan concern. There are Democratic mayors, Republican mayors, red states, blue states, and all of us were echoing those concerns. I think the other two issues that people were talking about a lot was, of course, immigration. We need people. And so the way that we're going about immigration enforcement is causing a lot of concerns to people who advocate on the part of immigrants and the and businesses, quite frankly, that need the labor supply. And then I think the third thing that we did spend a fair amount of time talking about is the environment. You know, we owe it to our communities to ensure that we're continuing to do the things that we need to do to protect our communities, to be more resilient, to respond to climate change, to get lead out of lead pipe, you know, the lead out of our pipes and our water. And so some concerns around and ideas around how do we continue to move that work forward when it is viewed negatively by this administration.
One of the questions I was going to ask you, which you answered, but so a lot of bipartisan support, but concern, bipartisan concern on many of the same issues.
Yeah, we will be back in Washington lobbying. I did a fly-in that we talked about, gosh, I lost track of time, with a group of mayors, again, Democrat, Republican. We met with a lot of Republicans, talked about these concerns. We believe we're going to have to go back and do more. But this is about public safety. This is about the future of our communities. This is about making sure that our communities are more sustainable. I mean, how do you cut FEMA and say that we're not going to invest in clean energy and in resiliency at the same time? So these are things that the long-term impacts of them are devastating, and the short-term impacts on our families, on our local economy. I mean, we're talking about taking $16 million out of the hands and pockets of landlords who receive funding for vouchers for those who get Section 8 housing. So this is going to have an impact short-term and then, of course, longer-term when we think about the environmental impacts.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask a question that I know my colleague Teresa Bourgeois would be mad if I didn't ask, which is, was there good news?
A lot of good things are happening. Well, first of all, I'm going to admit something I normally don't admit because I'm not running for re-election, but we were entertained by Flo Rida on Thursday night.
Well, there you go.
And a good time was had by all.
Absolutely.
So that was fun. But, you know, mayors are doing really innovative things across the country. And we remain united in our commitment to ensuring that we're creating resilient communities, that we're investing in trees, for example, to deal with heat items, heat islands. Hello. Anybody walk the streets of Albany these last couple of days? It was oppressive. And so this is work that is urgently needed. And we all talked about different ways that we can continue to do this. We need for the community to be involved. We need for people to recognize that what's happening in Washington might set us back, but it shouldn't stop this work from going forward. And that we as a community, if we come together, can continue the progress that we've made.
Anything you wanted to add, Teresa?
Yeah, I think I just echo what you're saying. I mean, the HUD cuts, 54% of the budget they're proposing. More than the only deeper cuts are in the State Department, which I think is 56% of the State Department is what they're proposing. But already, you know, you're seeing that to have rental assistance go away, you can't have rental assistance for more than 2 years if you have able-bodied adults in the home. You know, what's that going to do to the individuals? What's that going to do to the communities? What's that going to do? I mean, developers, is that going to make them hesitant to get into affordable housing? I mean, the compounding impacts of just those HUD cuts. And this is an administration that is, they say fentanyl every other word when they're talking about why they're doing what they're doing at the border. Yet at the same time, and you've already seen it now, deep cuts, as you've talked about, in the mental health programs. And they want to essentially abolish the department that the Congress set up to focus on mental health and drug addiction. And, you know, I just don't know how these numbers add up.
No, it is going to cost
a city function.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about waste, fraud, and abuse,
this is
going to cost us so much more in the long run.
Right.
And we just announced this week that we are launching another program with the county that is putting a street psychiatrist into the community that can actually prescribe right in the community, because some of the things that we see is people come to Albany Medical Center, the Region 1 Trauma Center, they get medicated, they get released, and then they don't get their prescription refilled for a whole host of reasons. So being able to meet people where they are, but it all is going to rely on that activity being reimbursable by Medicaid.
Right.
And so if you take that away, imagine what we are going to see in our streets and in our community. And SNAP benefits, those SNAP benefits get spent in our local stores,
right,
in our local economy. The rental assistance. The rental assistance doesn't go to the tenant. The rental assistance goes to the landlord.
Right.
And so whether that's a one- or two-family house in Albany, we have a lot of landlords that do take those Section 8 vouchers, or the larger developments that we have of low-income housing, that is going to have a direct economic impact. I mean, do we really want to crash the real estate market this moment in time?
And that's what this is going to do.
Right. So I think that you know, these systems are all interconnected, and these are dollars that are spent in our community. And that's what we need to continue to talk about, because I do think it's giving some of the members in Congress pause. We saw it in the news today that there are Republicans that are pushing back on this. And I think it's because people like mayors are saying, wait a minute, this is the direct impact in this rural hospital. It's right. going to lose X percent of their revenue. And so they're thinking about it. But and the other thing that I say is that these tax cuts are already in place. They make it sound like there's going to be this huge tax cut, and so there's going to be all this extra money in the economy. Well, it's already baked in.
Right. But the interesting is, and I think people need to understand, this isn't something far away. This is something that the president, in fact, he's having an event at the White House this afternoon on some of these cuts, that this is something that they want to pass by July 4th. A big not the rental assistance changes, but the Medicaid, Medicare, and what I don't think has gotten enough attention is they also are putting in a whole series of changes that will essentially cause the Affordable Care Act to fall in on itself, to cave in on itself economically because of the changes they're making to it. They've been trying to destabilize the so-called Obamacare Affordable Care Act. And so now the calculation is that more than 16 million Americans will lose their health care directly. But the indirect impact of that is in urban areas, it's going to hurt hospitals. In rural areas, it's going to hurt hospitals. And when you hurt hospitals, you hurt employers. They're often a major employer in a community. Albany Med, St. Peter's, what percentage is the medical community of the economy in Albany, right? And same thing in rural areas. And so when you dismantle that, then you dismantle all the economy around it, right? So it's bad for the individual patient, but it's bad for the economy. I just heard on the way in that they, by 2030, the medical industry in this country will be 27% of the economy, just because there's going to be such a greater demand on it as a baby boomers age. But the sort of economic and also this administration says they're pro-law enforcement. But look at all of the changes, and that's going to happen in the next week on law on guns, having to do with guns. They're dismantling the anti-violence programs. Mm-hmm. They're dismantling, making it easier to get more dangerous weapons. It's really the broad brush of what they're doing to universities and cutting university research. All of these are going to have compounding impact.
We have 90 seconds before we have to take a break. Does anybody want to add anything to that conversation?
Is there any good news?
I'm going to add to that that the idea, I mean, the justification to cut costs and save money and bring the debt down, of course, is ludicrous in light of the fact that the tax cuts, the existing tax cuts and the additional tax cuts will, I looked up the data, will come up to a total of $3.8 trillion with an estimated $1.5 trillion spending cuts that adds an extra $2.4 trillion of the nation's deficits over the decade. And I think that's important to remember that the justification is just...
That number, I think, is why some Republicans are pushing back.
Right. And also these tax benefits, the cost, because of the range of cuts, for the lower income people, they're not going to get the tax benefits. Right. It's going to be wiped out by the rising costs, as well as with all the costs of tariffs that are going to raise the prices on people.
When we come back, we have much more to talk about, including a press conference that took place this morning and much more going on. And we'll get to all of that on the other side of a break. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Keep them short and to the point, and that way we can get to as many as possible. We'll return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday. I'm going to keep doing it. Thursday morning, and we welcome you to the proceedings, and thank you very much for being with us. So let's begin with this. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth opened a news conference Thursday at the Pentagon by attacking the media over reports questioning the extent of damage to Iranian nuclear sites by U.S. airstrikes early Sunday. This continued what we heard yesterday. If you were listening to this program yesterday, we included the President of the United States news conference from the NATO summit in the Netherlands, where he went after specifically CNN and New York Times for their coverage of the questioning of the extent of damage, and going so far as to say that that was maligning the troops who were responsible for dropping the bombs, and they were saying they were not doing their jobs. Hegseth said, because you cheer against President Donald Trump so hard, it's in your DNA and your blood, because you want him not to be successful so bad, you have to cheer against the efficacy of these strikes, Hegseth said, ahead of comments by General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that included additional details on the planning and execution of the U.S. strikes. At the White House, the president, and you mentioned this, plans to hold an event later today to make the case for passage of his massive tax and immigration package as the Senate eyes a vote in the coming days, with July 4th being the deadline. General Kane told the news media there were early indications Iran was planning a retaliatory attack on Monday in Qatar, which forced commanders there to mostly empty the facility. Fewer than 50 U.S. troops remained to defend the base, using two Patriot missile batteries, he said. We believe that this is the largest single Patriot engagement in U.S. military history. Malia.
It just strikes me that Pete Hegseth was acting more like a Fox News, not surprisingly, a Fox News commentator than a Secretary of Defense at this press conference, which I did not see. Apparently, it happened while I was driving up here. So I'm hearing this the same time as our radio listeners. But I also want to just share some insight into how what's called the battle damage assessment process typically works. So it's the fact that some of this information was leaked a couple days ago, and then there's a different assessment coming out now. The leak. I'm very curious to see how this administration continues to maybe go after leakers or not. Were they behind the leak themselves? I mean, that's a whole political question, I think. But the fact that there are updates to the assessment coming out is not necessarily political, because battle damage assessment is a process, and it's dependent on a whole series of intelligence tools that are not that you have to bring together, and a whole series of coordinations that have to be done that can be time consuming, and you don't have all the information immediately. So there's always some kind of initial assessment, and then as you get more details, an updated assessment is done. So that in itself is not different from what would typically happen. The fact that we sitting here in the civilians know about it, that's what's different. And some of the tools feeding into the battle damage assessment are probably Israeli intelligence. They have much better intelligence in Iran than any other country in the world. And they're not leaking their intelligence, but no doubt they're sharing some of it with us. And so that's a time-consuming process as well to get whatever their assessment is. And we may never know, and the intelligence community may never know the full extent of what exactly happened. We know some damage was done, and so there's always an element of informed speculation, let's say, about what the likelihood is of the degree of damage and how that impacts Iran's ability to continue building a nuclear bomb.
We just heard from the BBC at the bottom of the hour the report that from Iran that the U.S. did not really gain anything in this, and it was just, I believe the word they used was showmanship. How much can we with that story?
Yeah.
I'm curious as to how seriously we can take that assessment.
Well, if you take sort of a longer view, this is it, in a larger sense. Yes, you could say there's some showmanship here. I mean, the whole reason that Iran was re-pursuing this nuclear weapons was because Trump tore up the agreement that had existed. And so the fact that now they restarted their program, let's make no mistake, this is a murderous regime in Iran that has financed terrorism in many regions of the world for a very long time and is responsible for the deaths of many, many people. There should be no qualms about anyone being against Iran getting a nuclear weapon, at least from the perspective of U.S. security, the security of our people overseas. I think there's a lot of bipartisan agreement on that, and there has been for many years. But how do you stop them from getting a weapon? The agreement that was in place appeared to have been working, but Trump didn't believe it, got rid of it. And now, so they started pursuing nuclear weapons, and then so he, instead of trying to put an agreement in place again, he goes in and bombs them. Now maybe that is what impelled them to come back to the table for a ceasefire, but it seems like the entire situation was unnecessary, and it probably wouldn't have happened if that agreement had remained in place.
But can I just ask a question? Is part of this, and I don't know because I haven't gone back and looked, but part of this is that Trump came out before the planes had even returned to their airbase and said that something along the lines of there's been a complete annihilation or whatever that was.
Right.
And so we have a president that, he got out over his skis on it, right? I mean, the president should have come out and said, we had a successful mission, they hit their targets, and they've returned home, right? And so now we're arguing about this, and it is frustrating because it's divisive. I don't want to talk about him. I want to talk about what you just talked about. I want to talk about policy. I want to talk about the future. I want to talk about what it means. right? And so that is, I think, you started this with saying that you were quoting, saying that, like, we hate Trump so much that we're just going to jump on everything. Well, you know what? I think Trump had a very successful NATO visit, right? I think a strong NATO benefits all of us. And we might not like his tactics, but I think based on what the NATO leaders are saying, they feel as though they're building a stronger NATO, right? So I do think, how do we get away from this polarizing personal attack? And
even a broken clock is right twice a day. So that's like, yeah, I think the analysis has to.
Don't you wonder whether in the scripted remarks of the word obliterated was on the screen?
Does he read what's on the screen? I think.
Well,
that's
what I mean. Yeah. I'm just wondering if the people who are preparing that would have put the word obliterated or that was added.
I don't think they would have had him talk as.
They may have known that's the kind of thing that he likes to say, and so they would have. I mean, it's like that. Everything he does is he just has such a political instinct, and so on this, on every other initiative that he has, he's going to say it's the biggest, best, most beautiful bill. We obliterated I think that's part of what his supporters like about him. They like this aura that he tries to project of triumph and success, and they don't necessarily take him exactly literally. They're like, okay, it was good. Now we get the details about what actually happened, but generally they think. This was positive, the fact that the CIA felt compelled to release another update to sort of correct the record is really unusual.
But this seems a little odd. I mean, clearly trying to create his own reality, right, by saying obliterated. And also saying there's a ceasefire when in fact maybe there hadn't been an agreed ceasefire because then there was silence for a long time, right? But the thing that I find fascinating, and this is probably too complex, but they could have succeeded in deeply destroying the Fordo site, right, and damaging the other two, and not have fully disrupted the Iranian program. Right? Both can be true. It can be true that they, and we don't know yet if they fully destroyed the Fordo site because, and this is what the IAEA and Bulletin Atomic Science is where I get my background. I try to educate myself about this because I'm not in any way close to an expert. But one of the things that I read is it's so deep that even these it's not right.
Bunker busting
bombs. Thank you. Oh my gosh! As powerful as they are, it is so deep that it would take several of them and to have it work just right to fully destroy the facility. Now they did say today, General Kane did say that they were able to drop four of them on the site, so that was a big success. But you still don't know. Yeah. But even whether they did or not, that doesn't mean that they have dismantled. The capacity for Iran to create a nuclear weapon, right?
No, it did demonstrate the willingness to take extraordinary action to prevent them from getting a weapon.
Right.
So I think Iran's retaliation by firing missiles at the Al-Udeid air base was also performative. They couldn't not take some action against the United States, but they clearly are... concerned about self-preservation, and so they had to take some kind of retaliatory action. They told us they're going to, so we could prepare, we could evacuate the base, make sure that everything's ready, and worked very closely and well with it. I mean, this is actually a good example of our alliance with Qatar and how well that worked to protect the people of Qatar and the people at Al-Udeid Air Base. I think the Iranians are probably whether or not this particular strike ended or obliterated or whatever their program, they are probably reassessing, and it may drive them to I don't know to what extent they could be more secretive about it. Maybe they'll somehow become even more secretive, so it'll be harder to track. And so then it would be harder to strike in the future if some remnants of it remain. Or, you know, or they could decide we want to put a pause on this and see how we can get some gains out of this situation.
Let me
pause, because okay. I want to take a break, and then I do want to get to another aspect of this as well. We'll hold here. We'll do the business of the people, and then we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our discussion this morning. We have Malia Dumont, Karen Riedel, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mayor Kathy Sheehan with us. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. As we are discussing, there was a press conference this morning with Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, talking about the military action over the weekend and what has taken place over the past week. One other thing that I wanted to add to the discussion, we can certainly continue down the avenues that we have started to go down, but I wanted to add to this of the White House planning to limit classified intelligence sharing with Congress after leaks to the press of an early assessment undermined President Donald Trump's claim that U.S. airstrikes obliterated Iranian nuclear facilities. This will make this contentious just by its nature amid a political battle over what the intelligence shows. The White House is expected to send four of its top national security officials to brief lawmakers Pete Hegseth, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to administration officials. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, who testified in March that U.S. intelligence agencies assessed that Iran was not building a nuclear weapon, will be notably absent. I think we are being struck in the studio, oddly enough. While there is an argument going on of whether this was done legally and Congress should have approved it, it seems odd that you would further limit information to Congress on what then happened.
Well, and Congress has an oversight responsibility.
Yes.
So I think there are legal reasons. That would be really interesting if members of Congress sued the administration for not to have their access to classified information limited. But they are required to have that information so they can perform their duties as our elected representatives. And Congress has been set up that way for a very long time. There are classified briefing rooms. The people who are on the House Armed Services Committee. That's Senate Armed Services. But on these committees that oversee various parts of the defense establishment and national security establishment have not just themselves the right clearances, but they have staff who have clearances who specialize in these things, and that is their staff's portfolio. And so there's a whole apparatus set up to enable this relationship between Congress and the national security establishment to make sure that that the laws that Congress is passing and the money that it's appropriating is used in the way intended. And they can't do that if they don't have all the right access.
And am I right that they didn't? There's something called the Gang of Eight, which are the top Democrat and Republican on each of the core committees of jurisdiction. And in the past, they've always been notified in advance. And in this case, they only notified the Republicans and the Gang of Eight. They did not notify the Democrats, which is highly regular. So not only not sharing information, but not even notifying them.
Did they check their Slack apps? Maybe it was on there.
They said, and apparently they didn't reach Hakeem Jeffries either, which I don't know why that happened.
Not that this is surprising, and I don't pretend that I find this at all surprising, but the whole idea of why it's being limited is so that because Trump felt that he was undermined in this, that there was information that was leaked to the press that he didn't want leaked to the press.
And then somehow blaming that on Congress.
Yes, and there's no evidence that it had anything to do with congressional oversight that the information was leaked.
Not to mention CNN and New York Times, who got scolded yesterday for their actions for reporting the story about a report that came out guarding the assessment of the damage. Yeah.
Can I ask, I worry about not so much that, but the undermining of the intelligence system, of the cuts in staff, and the national security staff within the White House. He doesn't have a national security advisor. Well, on paper it's Rubio, but you can't be the Secretary of State and the national security advisor at the same time. They're different tasks. But also they've reduced and want to reduce even further the number of people collecting intelligence. And also because, as you allude to, if you're not handling classified information in a proper way, then other countries are going to be, you know, more concerned about giving us intelligence. Is that, based on your experience, Malia, is that something we should be worried about?
I don't know enough about these proposed cuts, because the intelligence community has expanded a lot over the past 20 years, especially since 9/11, and not all of it, in fact, a large percentage of what I know of that, I mean, it's very shadowy, of course, is in the bureaucracy of it. You know, this whole new bureaucracy was created, the Director of National Intelligence, to bring together a bunch of agencies to make sure there was better coordination, because one of the lessons learned from 9/11 is that some of these agencies weren't sharing with each other. And so the instinct to create another bureaucracy went into full gear. And so it's not necessarily going to I'm not sure, for where I sit, that bureaucracy has really been super effective in increasing the quality of American intelligence. It's hard to draw a direct line there. So if cuts are to some of that bureaucracy, I'm not sure what kind, you know, that may not be terrible. If it's to the collectors out there, yes. Then that's a whole different question. If it's in places where we have agreements with allies, we have a very strong what's called Four Eyes community, you know, intelligence sharing agreements with Canada, the UK, and Australia, where we're able to cut back because they have a stronger presence or stronger knowledge in some area. You know, that's not necessarily a bad thing as long as we're able to keep sharing with them. I think there's some questions The more we see leaks of intelligence in the United States press, the more some of our allies are going to be like, wait a minute, are we able to continue sharing?
I'm not so much thinking about leaks. I'm thinking about the signal, you know, the information that they were conveying on signal among the leadership.
Well, I call that, that's for me, that's a form of a leak.
Okay.
So these are all different kinds of leaks. It's whether you're leaking it deliberately, sort of surreptitiously leaking a report, or you're leaking information because you're trumpeting your own success on an unclassified platform. I mean, those are all forms of leaks.
And to your family.
Boxes yeah. of classified documents in a bathroom and a
yeah,
public
yeah,
place.
Yeah, poor information security.
All right, let's go to a couple letters and then we'll take a break at the top of the hour. Leslie writes, it is my understanding that the bunker-busting bombs were actually ordered by Obama to have in his back pocket in case Iran didn't abide by the nuclear agreement that he signed. So Trump ended the deal, then used Obama's ordered bombs. I don't know.
That's what General Kane described today, and he said it started in 2008, so that is accurate.
Dan writes to us and says, as much as I despise the Trump and MAGA agenda, I must applaud their vision and gusto to go for their goals. This is the upside-down world of FDR's New Deal. Democrats and liberals need to take a lesson from this playbook. Go big or go home. Example, Obama wanted universal health care. He settled for what we got, which is somewhat better than what we had, but still a big gift to insurance companies and lots of hassle and unsurety since it is still tied to employment. A lot more folks would be seeing the light right now if we went full single payer. That is from Dan. Then we check in with Linda. Great show as always, says Linda. Don't forget everybody is walking on eggs concerning Trump. Don't forget Israel is thrilled that Trump did bomb. Iran is going to be hesitant reporting that it wasn't as successful because they know that will upset Trump. So who knows? Then we go to this letter from Rachel. I disagree with the statement that people do not take Trump literally. They do. I believe he largely won the election because the promises were taken literally. And Dems got caught up in logistics. Trump said, I will lower egg prices. And then he says, I lowered egg prices. And it does not really matter if he did or didn't because it's something that people believe. The media is struggling to present a truthful narrative because they get sued if they do not. Dear leader, everything. It is a dangerous situation, but Trump's base 100% believes every single word he says. That from Rachel.
Just to follow up on that. So when I said that, I was recalling an analysis I found really interesting during Trump's first term, where somebody in the media described his base as, well, the difference between people who voted for him and voted against him is that those who voted for him took him seriously, but not literally. And those who voted against him took him literally, but not seriously. And I thought that was really interesting and astute. And that's kind of that's the dynamic I was referring to with my remark there. I think the person who wrote in is correct. Like people, they're taking him at his words, but maybe not with the specificity. And they're still supporting him. They still think it was, you know, the success he's projecting. Like, that's what they're taking seriously.
Do I take Ray Graff seriously? No. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our program one more hour with this wonderful group, and we'll continue on other subjects. Meanwhile, stand by for news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning, the 26th of June. And let me reintroduce the panel. Teresa Bourgeois is here, public policy and communications expert. Malia Dumont, chief of staff and vice president for strategy and policy at Bard College. Dr. Karen Riedel is associate professor of government at Dutchess Community College. And since 2023, has been president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. And we also welcome the mayor of the city that we are in right now, the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. Welcome back to you all. Thank you so much for spending time with us. So let's talk about the budget. Let's talk about tax cuts, because if I don't, Teresa will slip my tires.
It's what matters most in people's lives.
I know.
Lives, right
I
now.
Know that.
Right now.
A handful of Senate Republicans joined Democrats on Wednesday in sharp questioning of President Trump's proposed budget cuts, exposing the depth of congressional unease with the White House's new plan to pare back billions of dollars for foreign aid and public broadcasting. The rare display of bipartisan discord left the fate of that package uncertain at a moment when the Trump administration has signaled that it is willing to circumvent Congress to slash federal spending, potentially touching off a constitutional battle over the power of the purse. The dynamic played out over a terse, roughly three-hour grilling of Russell Vogt, the White House budget director, who asked lawmakers to approve Mr. Trump's request to rescind more than $9 billion in enacted funds. The administration has framed the package unveiled this month as the first of possibly many that could implement changes identified by the Department of Government Efficiency or DOGE to its friends. Meanwhile, we mentioned this a couple of times today, but there is a race going on, And the president has said no one goes on vacation. That was all in chatty caps. Until the big, beautiful bill is on his desk by the 4th of July deadline, and Republicans in Congress are staying put to get it done. The Senate is gearing up for weekend work, while House Speaker Mike Johnson told lawmakers Tuesday to keep their schedules, quote, flexible, as they prepare for more votes. We're making good headway, said Senate Majority Leader John Thune. He expects the Senate will get this past the finish line by the end of the week, sending it back to the House for swift action. However, Republicans who have majority control of the House and Senate are finding that their push to move fast and change things, namely cuts to federal government programs, including Medicaid and SNAP food stamps, used by millions of Americans, is easier said than done. I take that information, I put it into a box, I put a cover on it, I wrap it, put a big bow on it, and I hand it to Teresa Bourgeois.
To start, but lots of experience here that I want to hear from. Let me just say, this is kind of confusing, but there are four things going on simultaneously, some with deadlines that the president has set, artificial deadline of July 4th. But the first thing is the Trump administration cuts that DOGE, primarily led by DOGE, but also some of the department heads, have either frozen funding, pulled back grants, laid off people in ways that there are a whole series of court cases saying that it's not consistent with the law because it's not following through on the directives of the Congress, right? And so cuts to university-based research, think Harvard, but it's really universities all over the country who had research grants, and those have been frozen. You had a situation, the mayor was talking earlier about clean water. You had a situation in Milwaukee where they have frozen funding and programs to get lead out of the pipes and literally stopped in its tracks. Some programs over the country got a lot of attention in Milwaukee because they pipes in a school building, so 12 school buildings. So that is being litigated. Separately, and this is a contested hearing yesterday, that the White House wants to codify some of those cuts, and so they've sent up what's called a rescission package. They're saying that we want to cut this $9 billion. Now, they've already cut it, but they want to go back and make it legal that they've cut it. And that's where the funding is for all the USAID, the food security programs, those kinds of things, as well as that's where the funding for PBS and NPR is. And then there is this rescission bill, the reconciliation bill, and that's the huge one. That's where the Medicaid cuts, the SNAP cuts, all the clean energy programs where they want to pull back the money, and that's where the huge tax cuts are. And that's got the $4 trillion price tag, of which only a small portion is paid for. And then the last is preparing for the next year's budget that has to be done before October 1st. But the biggest, looming, costliest thing, I think, is this $4 trillion package. And that's where they want to cut Medicaid and Medicare. They say they're not cutting Medicare, but some of the things that they're doing will automatically trigger cuts in Medicare. That's where they're going to cut the Affordable Care Act, make it much harder to access the Affordable Care Act. That's where they're going to stop a lot of the clean energy programs. That's where they're going to try to sell off American lands. That's where, anyway, Mayor, you're the mayor of a city. Tell us, what will that do to a city?
Well, we had a meeting with so all across the country, there are these groups that are responsible for the continuum of care. And so that is an entity that brings all of the homeless providers, you know, mental health, typically under the auspices of the counties, because in New York State, the counties are responsible for social services. And so they've done an initial assessment of the impacts, and they held a meeting recently with Albany, Rensselaer, and Schenectady counties to talk about what those impacts are going to be within each of those counties. And so we are talking about thousands of people, including in Rensselaer County, which is seen as a red county, that will become homeless within 90 days. The impacts with respect to those who are getting support services, once those support services are discontinued. And so we're already looking at what those impacts would be, what the costs are associated with them, determining are there interim actions that we can take? Where do you house 1,000 people that are suddenly, that were housed and permanently housed in most cases, and then get them into temporary shelter? And so that work is happening at the local level, and the planning is happening at the local level. But it's really devastating. And we have funding that we've put up of our own tax dollars, local tax dollars, to launch these mental health support services. But again, in order for those to be sustainable going forward, you get these case managers out there. They interact with somebody who's experiencing homelessness or mental health issues. And typically the first thing that case manager does is get that person enrolled in the benefits that will help them to eventually be able to get the health care they need, Medicaid, housing, these very programs that are being cut, so that they workforce development. We haven't talked about that, but a lot of workforce development money is being cut. And so those are all things that are food. Those
law
are
all enforcement, things that are, violence prevention money.
That are critically important. So, yes, there is violence prevention money that is being cut. But the impact then, we did all of these things to try to take things off of law enforcement's plate. Right. And so if we're going to be able to continue on that path so that our law enforcement officers can be focused on violent crime and on crime, you know, on property crimes, then if we want to be able to continue that success that we've seen in cities across the country, crime is down. That was one of the things we celebrated at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Crime is down everywhere, precipitously. And so in order to be able to continue on that path, this would really be devastating to that, and I think really set us back. And so I think that's what we're talking about at the local level. That's what we're looking at, and we're going to need all hands on deck, because the state can fill the void for a little while, but I don't know a single person who thinks that they could pay significantly more in property taxes to make up for the millions and millions of dollars that we would ultimately lose here in the city and across the county. And this impacts rural low-income folks as well as urban low-income folks. This is going to have devastating impacts all across Albany County, Rensselaer County, the region, and really have, I think, ultimately, it will require much more money to fix it when it all falls apart.
Can I say one other thing? A big portion of this bill is a hefty price tag piece of it is funding for this deportation campaign. And it's, I think, ironic that that there is, at the same time they're cutting funding for housing, there is $46 billion to give to these private prison companies to create 100,000 detention beds around the country. And think of all the outcry about putting people in hotels. But now this prison industry program is just becoming very, very lucrative. And
And just to add to that, there is no immigration package on the table here.
Right.
This is, you talk about an opportunity to go big. This is, we've got a Republican in the White House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House, and they could pass immigration reform and get that passed through tomorrow if they had the will. We want, and every mayor I talk to wants, fix immigration at the border. Make it easier, more understandable, create clear rules of the road. When you talk about undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants or all these terms that get tossed about, people have no idea how complex we have made immigration in this country. It makes figuring out your tax deductions look like child's play. And so you could have a family here where one person has an H-1B visa, another has a different type of status, another has a work status. I mean, the fact that we are where we are in a place where we're going to spend billions of dollars imprisoning people in private prisons instead of just fixing it should be infuriating to every American out there.
Especially given that we had a bill in place that could have solved many of the issues you just addressed, and which was simply killed for political purposes.
Malia?
You brought up the private prisons, and I had been thinking of that. Listening to you speak, Kathy, I was like, that's people who are cynical may want, you know, that's where they're going to be investing their money, right? Because that's the area of the economy that's going to be growing more. And the kind of jobs that are going to be in these private prisons, they are not they're not jobs that require a lot of largely a lot of education or are producing things. I mean, it's not good for the people in the prisons, whether they're incarcerated or not. You know, it's just a drain, a spiritual drain on this country.
So interesting. There's also a company called Palantir, and they have gotten a huge contract to do create a database system of who to target. You know, all the ICE raids, who they're targeting. And as it turns out, there was news reported this in the last week that Stephen Miller is his family has a pretty significant investment in that company. Stephen Miller, of course, being the White House person who's leading this effort. But the price tags here are amazing. $46.5 billion for border barrier construction, $46.5 billion. Now, what if some of that money instead was invested in expanding the number of people at the courts, you know, doing the reviews, expanding the number of people doing the paperwork so that, you know, there's a big outcry because a lot of the Border Patrol was getting involved in so much paperwork because they didn't have the staff to do it. What if they actually staffed up the process of reviewing people so you could determine who to let in and who not, right? You wouldn't have all of these courts, but...
And so many of what they're referring to as illegal
right.
immigrants are people who are having difficulty navigating the frickin' paperwork, right? That's what we're talking about.
Right.
These are civil violations.
Right.
Imagine if we created private prisons for everybody who was being audited by the IRS. We're going to incarcerate you while we're auditing you.
Right.
I mean, these are individuals, most of whom entered this country with some status and either through their own fault, through the fault of an attorney who might have taken advantage of them, somebody who gave them the wrong information when they went to ICE. So many places along the way for people to fall through the cracks. That's what we're talking about. I mean, look, I don't want violent criminals in my city. I don't care where they're from. I don't want violent criminals in my city. And I think, you know, people expect that to be the focus of any enforcement efforts. But when you look at who's being targeted and what is being described as heinous crimes, you know, petty larceny. So, you know, any of you guys, people out there who had a kid shoplift, you know, that's being considered a heinous crime. When it's described as this individual was convicted of petty larceny. You know, there was an individual who went to get his green card re-upped, and he had he's an artist, and he had tagged the side of what he thought was an abandoned storage shed, and it turns out it wasn't. And so he pled guilty, he paid a fine, and it got fixed. And now they want to deport him because he committed a heinous crime. I mean, this is what we're talking about.
But I will also note that there was a speech given by the Vice President, J.D. Vance, in Ohio in this past week that I found stunning, where what he talked about is not that we want them to leave because of committing violent crimes, which had been the rhetoric for the last 2 years. But he said that these people, the Democrats, are trying to import voters. He said Republicans persuade voters. Democrats are trying to import voters, and we're going to get them out. So is that really the reason? Is that what's behind this, that they don't want to have these folks become citizens, so they're going to deport them? Now, who are they deporting? I don't want to get going on this. The Marine whose wife 9 weeks ago had a baby. She doesn't have full status yet. She's in the process of getting it. She goes, she reports the way she's supposed to, and she, you know, she gets a notice that she's supposed to come in and report. She goes to do that to remain legal, and they detain her. And now she's being held, and they want to deport her. They have a 3-year-old and a 9-week-old. And the father is an enlisted active duty Marine. Is that, you know, they were talking about being disrespectful to the military. Is that disrespectful to the military? What about the guy who was mowing at IHOP? and he gets beaten up, and his three sons, three adult sons who he raised here in this country, all three Marines, two active duty, one retired Marine. He's in detention, perhaps going to be deported. And again, data shows 7% of the people that they've detained so far, at tremendous cost, not only dollar cost, but what are all these agents, what otherwise would they be doing, right? 7% have actual violent criminal records.
I want to just take a moment that the breaking news, we're starting to get Supreme Court decisions that are...
I'm sorry, we got to talk about clean energy cuts.
Add this to your day. The Supreme Court on Thursday allowed South Carolina to bar Planned Parenthood's access to federal Medicaid funding for non-abortion services. The decision allows states to ban the organization from getting Medicaid reimbursements for cancer screenings and other care not related to abortion. Issue is a provision of the federal Medicaid law that guarantees Medicaid patients the ability to choose their doctors, or in the words of the statute, they are entitled to, quote, any qualified and willing provider. South Carolina, however, maintained that it could disqualify Medicaid providers for any reason that state law allows. Or, as Governor Henry McMaster, a Republican, put it, taxpayers should not be forced to subsidize abortion providers who are in direct opposition to their beliefs. And on Thursday, the Supreme Court voted by 6-3. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote for the court majority.
I just want to say, but we should be able to have taxpayers pay for religious schools and schools that want to promote Christianity. I know that the hypocrisy has always been there, but I when we've got these same folks advocating for religious charter schools and public dollars going to Christian charter schools, and by the same token saying, but we can't have taxpayer dollars go to fund a healthcare provider with whom you might disagree. It's crazy.
For individual choice, as long as your individual choice aligns with what I want you to choose.
And that's, they say, it doesn't align with the administration's views. And they say that's what people voted for. Do you think people really voted for blocking cancer screening for women or blocking access to prenatal care for women? Is that what the American people voted for?
When I was in law school, I had a high deductible plan. My health insurance, I couldn't afford health insurance. I bought whatever I could. And the only place that I could get affordable care for myself was at Planned Parenthood.
And it's important to note as well that federal funding was never allocated for actual abortion services. That was very clear
in federal
law. Yes.
Right. And so that was where I went for my health care. And many, many women, I called around. I had, again, high deductible plan. I called all kinds of places to see where can I go for my annual physical. And Planned Parenthood was the only place that I could afford. And so I think that this is just, again, we've protested this before. I remember protesting this back in 2017, 18.
Right.
We'll continue to do that. But it's frustrating because in New York, right, we have sane policies around this. But in other places, you're really denying health care to people.
Not just a lot of it is targeted at women.
Yes.
Right.
Women specifically are going to be disproportionately impacted by a lot of these cuts.
Which in HHS, by the way, wanting to eliminate the Women's Health Bureau, in the Justice Department, want to eliminate the Violence Against Women's Bureau. But one of the things you said is, where do we go to protest? I think one of the things I think it's very important for listeners to know is that there is time to lend your voice. And what seems to be breaking through is at the local level, having personal stories be conveyed about what's the actual impact of this. I know Congressman Tonko has, I think, been doing a great job at this, of trying to show by example what impact that this has.
10 seconds, so I'll pause you there. We'll come back. We'll finish up on the other side of a break. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this BBC News break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion and our last segment together for this Thursday. I wanted to just go over, we've been talking about the big bill, and it is a big bill, and there's a lot included. So what is the goal of it? Well, tax cuts. The top priority for Republicans is preventing what they warn would be massive tax hikes, some $3.8 trillion after Democrats win the tax breaks they put in place during Trump's first term in 2017 expire. The big bill seeks to make existing tax rates and brackets permanent while also temporarily adding new ones that Trump campaigned on. No taxes on tips, overtime pay, or some automotive loans, along with a bigger $6,000 deduction in the Senate draft for seniors who earn no more than $75,000 a year. The wealthiest households would see a $12,000 increase, while the bill would cost the poorest people $1,600 a year. The bill also funds deportations, a border wall, and Trump's Heroes Garden. There are some $350 billion of new funding in the package for Trump's border and national security agenda. Meanwhile, how to pay for it? Cuts to Medicaid, SNAP, and green energy programs to help party officials offset the lost tax revenues. Republicans are seeking to cut back some long-running government programs, such as Medicaid, food stamps, and green energy incentives, basically unraveling the accomplishments of the past two Democratic presidents, Joe Biden and Barack Obama. And then bringing us to that final question, which we've been discussing, what's the final cost? Although keeping the existing tax breaks and adding the new ones is expected to cost $3.8 trillion over the next decade, the CBO says in its analysis, Congressional Budget Office, that of the House bill, the Senate draft is higher. The spending cut tally is at least $1.5 trillion. The CBO estimates that the package from the House would add $2.4 trillion to the nation's deficits over the decade. don't worry, we'll be able to get you in for your cleaning momentarily.
I don't know if listeners can hear, but there's
a lot of noise, like a drilling going on.
So that they're proposing cuts for public radio, but do you have like somebody moving in upstairs? Are they creating?
You know what? Moving
people
in
might
or moving...
not be able to hear this, but
I don't know. Moving in or moving out, Kathy? I don't know which. I'm a little worried.
Odd noises in the studio today.
Yes. We're apparently work is being done, but that's all right. Okay, Teresa.
So the Trump administration, I think this is the fundamental reason for these cuts is that he wants to finance his tax cuts that, as we know, are directed primarily to the wealthiest of Americans. That was one of his campaign pledges. And he also, one of his big campaign pledges, because he had major donors in the oil and gas industry, is that he would do their bidding for them. And so this wipes out a lot of the clean energy programs. Now, a lot of that is solar, and this is why I don't understand Republicans in the House and the Senate. A lot of the funding in President Biden's clean energy initiative that was in the Inflation Reduction Act, much of that, the early adopters were so-called red states, the Republican-led states. And so if, in fact, the Senate Republicans and then the House Republicans go for this, they're going against their own constituencies. A lot of the Medicaid funding is in Republican-led states. If they support this, they're going against their own constituencies, So is the, and also they have long said that they don't want deficits, that they have to control government. Well, in fact, the last time these cuts were put into place, it exploded the debt, and it will even more so this time and create incredible economic upheaval. And so why the Republicans in the House and Senate would support this that hurts their own constituency, I don't know. But folks basically have a week to go back to their elected representatives. I mean, there are five key Republicans in New York State. If those five voted in the interest of the state and in the interest of their constituency, then this would be blocked. And you could go back to the drawing board and actually do good cost containment.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some statistics about which states have the most solar. Now, where's the Sun Belt in the United States? It's right through the Southwest. It's largely Republican. But the number one state, of course, is California. So maybe he's trying to aim it at California. But the number two, Texas, then Florida, then Arizona, then North Carolina, Nevada, Georgia. New York is number eight, actually. The majority, like the biggest solar farms in the United States, most of them are in these Republican states. And it's not just solar either. I mean, the last time I drove through West Texas, I was astonished at how many of these huge wind generators there were, just covering hillsides for miles. I mean, I was driving through this seemingly endless forest of wind generators.
And it's a lot of small businesses as well that have grown up around this. So, I mean, yeah. They're projecting 400,000 jobs lost just in the solar industry alone. But right here in our own backyard at GE, they retrofitted their plant in Schenectady, invested tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, and are building the large, you know, sort of turbine, not the blades, but the actual turbine that powers these things. Now, you know, GE is a big company, and they sell these internationally. And they ship them out of the port of Albany. This is a huge economic driver for our region. But they, I am quite certain, take advantage of every incentive that is currently available for spurring this industry. So this is about creating jobs. Imagine if you had just shut off the valve on the internet or, you know, the tech jobs that started to boom and grow because we had incentives in place to incentivize that innovation. And so these were incentives that were not just to make us feel good, but to create an industry and new jobs and new opportunities. And this pulls the rug out from under that and will ultimately result in layoffs, particularly as you noted, in red states.
And green industries that are really growing.
Yeah. And reshoring, you know, they say they want to reshore manufacturing. A big component of the Biden agenda was to reshore the solar industry in the United States. The technology came here. We lost it to China. A lot of pieces were in place to provide incentives to do that, to provide the trained workforce to do that. And anecdotal impact of what it means in a place like Cohoes, a low-income community where I'm from. When I was working there, we are developing the first of its kind in the country, floating solar. And with help, thank you, Congressman Tonko, $3 million, plus these tax incentives, relying on these federal tax incentives. Well, what that will do once it's in place, it's been a bit delayed, but once it's in place, it will save the city $500,000 a year. So not only are you generating clean energy, but you're doing it in a way that will contain costs for a low-income community.
And somebody needs to maintain that.
Right.
And we're using that in our workforce development, particularly with young people. We have an entire group that we've been training on welding for welding these huge towers that are needed for offshore wind. You know, this was a huge opportunity to, again, build jobs, grow the economy, and create low barrier to entry jobs. So we started training young people for that now. And again, now all of that has been placed on hold with the administration's, freezing of the offshore wind licenses and all of that work that was underway. And so Again, you know, hugely impactful, and not just for the GEs of the world. They can take care of themselves, but small businesses that grew up around maintaining these systems, you know, the rooftop installations, you know, most of those are done by small businesses in our communities, and by local employees who are trained here and who work here.
The other area is agriculture, that there is a whole portion of this to bring in the agriculture community into the clean energy agenda, and with methane and with agrovoltaics and so forth. And they have had grants pulled back, frozen, work that they were going to do to try to help sustain family farms and do it in a way with clean energy. And so these, all of this clawback, this has a cost. And who benefits from this? The highest economic earners get their tax break, but at what cost to most of us? But we can do something. We can call our members of Congress and say, this is not what, you know.
Can I take a leap from this discussion,
yes,
which is really fascinating. But it's like, so I have grown up in a country with a multi-party system where we don't see these shifts from one administration to the other. And of course, that is always the case here in this two-party system. When a new administration comes in, much of the achievements of the previous administrations are reversed. And that, what I'm, as I'm listening to your analysis, I mean, I'm reminded of the lack of sustainability of long-term policy making that we have in our system. So this bill is going to be passed, maybe by July 4th. And this is the future, and it's very bleak, but there will be another administration. I want to very briefly, if I may, Joe, look at New York and the recent the outcome of the primary elections, because
yes,
it is, I think, a gives us a basis for us to understand what is it that Democrats need to do to win elections in the future and reverse what's coming our way again. It's like, what is your take, Kathy?
You know, I think that you know, that's a complicated question, because when you think about in looking at what happened in New York City, for example, I assume that's partly what you're talking about. I think that surprised a lot of people. But that populist message obviously ultimately won the day. The issue then becomes, how do you deliver on that, right? I mean, how do you deliver on freezing rents and providing free childcare and free bus transportation in a place like New York City? And so, you know, I agree. I think, though, we're seeing the shift that you just talked about in pulling the rug out from prior administration's policies become much more whiplash-like. I think we've had in a Congress and with a president who actually abides by the separation of powers, an ability to slow things down. And this administration has accelerated the speed at which these changes are happening. I don't know that we've ever seen anything like this. It takes time. You know, I mean, when I became mayor in 2014, there were lots of things that I wanted to do. But the bottom line was, we still paid every employee on a paper timesheet, right? So I had to fix that first. And so, you know, and that takes time. And, you know, it takes an RFP process. First, you have to find the money, and then you have to have an RFP process, and then you have to, you know, purchase a system, and then you have to implement that system. And so these things take time. And I think that when you think about a budget as a policy document, it should take time. But this is, again, I think, unprecedented with the speed with which we're seeing this dismantling. And it's like, you know, it's the game of Jenga. I've never played Jenga, but I've watched people play
yes.
it, right? And at some point, they're going to pull something out, and the whole thing is going to fall, is what people, that's, I think, the sense that people have and the anxiety that people have.
Yes, the changes that they're doing are absolutely without precedent. And the dismantling of the federal workforce, the driving out of people, the dismantling. I mean, the U.S. is the envy of the world in our relationship between the private sector, the university systems, and the federal government in terms of investing in scientific discovery and innovation. And that's why we continue to grow. why would they dismantle that system? But they are. A lot of the changes he's making are not constitutional. They're not legal. The courts are stopping them. But what now they're trying to do is codify them to make them legal. And the impact is far-reaching and foreboding. So maybe this bill, all of these bills will pass. We'll see. The deadline of July 4th is an artificial deadline. But there is still time.
Ruth writes to us and says how inspiring and empowering it is to hear the voices of four compassionate and intelligent women on today's panel. Hearing the real life stories of people who are and will be dangerously impacted by cruel funding cuts would be a wonderful daily addition to the roundtable. Right here in the Capital Region are people who need for their stories to be told, and we, the WAMC listeners, would learn a great deal by hearing them. Thank you, dear Joe, for all you do. Warm regards to each of you, and that from Ruth. So a nice
thank
way
you,
to
Ruth.
End the program on this Friday morning. I thank you all for being here. Thank you for your contributions. Have a beautiful rest of the week and weekend, and we'll be back after this short break.